1 year ago, the mask came off and the gloves came off. 1 year ago, a spark was lit. 1 year ago, a political era in Russia ended and another began. On December 4th, 2011, a disputed election to the State Duma and widespread documentation of voter fraud and other shenanigans inflamed public opinion, set off a wave of protests, divided the elite, and ended the political invincibility that Vladimir Putin had enjoyed for over a decade. And 6 days later, on December 10th, 2011, the largest nationwide demonstration of the post-Soviet era took place in Moscow and other cities. Powered by a newly engaged middle class and connected by social media, a new Russian civil society seemed to be coming of age before our eyes. And although Putin has managed to get himself reelected for a third term with a big assist from the Kremlin's many administrative resources, something in Russia has irrevocably changed. Much has happened since, from the Pussy Riot trial to the legislative crackdown and dissent to the current campaign against corruption. And as a turbulent 2012 draws to a close, it's clear that Russia is in the midst of an important transformation. What isn't yet clear? A transformation to what? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Kirill Kobrin is off this week traveling, and I'm not making this up, somewhere in the Arctic Circle. Filling in for Kirill from warmer environs are two members of the Power Vertical podcast team that listeners should be familiar with by now. On the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert in Russia's security services and author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Dan.
And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the eponymous and insightful Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean. It's good to have you.
Good to be here. Thanks. Hi, guys.
Earlier in the week, I spoke to longtime Russia watcher Edward Lucas, the international editor of The Economist and the author of the recently published book Deception. And I asked Ed to summarize this very tumultuous year in Russia. And I wanted to get the ball rolling with both of you to get you to react to what Ed had to say. Let's listen to what Ed had to say.
I think one could say that there's a general political failure on both the side of the regime and the opposition. The opposition wasn't able to capitalize on the mass protests we saw at the end of last year and hasn't managed to come out with a clear message, hasn't managed to come out with a clear leadership. So there's been a bit of a failure on that side. There's also been a failure on the regime side to maintain its internal coherence.
Mark, let's get the ball started with you. Get the ball rolling with you. Was this year a year of general political failure for both the opposition and the regime, or was Ed a little too harsh there?
No, I think I'd agree with him actually that this was a failure on both sides. What I would want to do is just slightly unpick what kind of failure. In the case of the opposition, on the whole, I think these were sins of omission. Things that they didn't do. They didn't organize properly. They didn't manage to find some kind of cohering principles. And perhaps most importantly of all, they didn't manage or even frankly seem to seek to want to reach out to the masses. There is a slight undercurrent, I think, of a sort of middle class elite disdain for the ordinary Russian masses. So they're things they didn't do. With the regime, I think it's more sins of commission. It's things that they did. Starting with the whole process of castling, moving through to the sort of heavy-handed and ham-fisted attempt to actually crush down the opposition, and a whole variety of different measures, including the current anti-corruption campaign, that really aren't working. So on the one hand, that makes the regime look more stupid. But on the other hand, precisely because at the moment I think actually the regime is still the active player. The opposition started very strongly, but have now become, I think, relatively passive and reactive, which means that there is, theoretically at least, a chance for the regime to actually change its policies and capitalize on this current brief, still window of opportunity.
Sean, your two cents?
In principle, I would generally agree with Lucas, but at the same time, I think it's also expecting too much. Beginning with the opposition, social and political movements take a long time to find their way. I think if we expect them to immediately capitalize on events and really pull themselves together and form some sort of coherent movement, then they certainly have not capitalized on the moment. But, I mean, if we look at political and social movements historically, it takes years for them to develop and find their way. And I think that despite all the criticisms, and I share many of the things that Marx said, you know, not finding a serious leadership, not fomenting a platform, not making connections with the broader public. While all of that is true, I think it's possible to just give them some kind of slack and see where they go over the next year and possibly over the year after that. In terms of the regime, I think also they're in a similar state. You know, here the Putin government or the Putin regime was confronted with a political movement that it had not experienced yet in its existence since the beginning of 2000s. And how they actually respond to a genuine opposition, first off, as Marx said, I think, yeah, the way they respond has been heavy-handed and not well thought out, and it makes them look stupid. But I think Putin coming back and then the shock of realizing that that was possibly a mistake, but one you have to live with, they're also trying to find their way. I think the Putin government is searching for an agenda, and they have yet to really find what that agenda is. And I wonder, from some of the things I've been reading in the media, I wonder if that agenda might be based on some kind of anti-corruption or shaking the system up.
My few cents here, for what it's worth, I see the year as kind of a holding pattern. I mean, these are like two boxers feeling each other out in the early rounds. I thought I was a little too harsh on the opposition on one hand, because in the first half of the year, they were truly driving the conversation. They were driving the national conversation. The things like, you know, the thieves and swindlers meme and all the other memes that Navalny put out there, those were becoming national catchphrases. There was a time when Putin had a monopoly on national catchphrases. I remember wipe them out in the latrine, right? Everybody in the country was saying that. And now it isn't him that was dry. It isn't him. I thought, and I know, Sean, you're skeptical of this, that I thought the coordinating committee was a smart and savvy move that has a lot of potential. It's infantile stages now, granted, but this was a move to kind of create and to reach out and to create a kind of common body that could speak for this undifferentiated mass we have out there. So I think, but again, yeah, it's in a holding pattern. On the regime side, I think it's hard to talk of a regime right now. The elite is so split. And the hardliners have had the upper hand for the first half of the year. But like I blogged this week, one of these things I'm waiting for is the moment when the technocratic wing of the elite makes common cause with the more moderate elements in the opposition movement. But I think the key development this year, and I wanted to get both of you to speak to this, because this is separate from the opposition. We often make this mistake of talking about this middle class opposition movement in society, and we kind of conflate it with the opposition, meaning whatever, Navalny, Kasparov, and company. The key development was the continued development of civil society, which is taking place, according to its own logic, in a lot of ways independent of the regime and independent of the opposition. Let's start with Mark the first time. Sean, what would you say to that?
Well, first on, I am skeptical of the coordinating council, if only because it reminds me of my experience in social activism and how when you get a bunch of politically minded people together, they seem to argue more about their own kind of individual identities rather than kind of think of a broader political idea beyond them. And I think that the slogans that they're kind of bickering over is indicative of that. I mean, what relevance does, say, free political prisoners have to any large segment of Russian society? But then again, you know, given the benefit of doubt and cut them some slack, they're still finding their way. The splits in the elite are very serious. And yeah, they're very serious because this has never boded well for Russia historically. A metaphor that comes up to me is one that was put forward by Leopold Hamsen to describe the latter years of the Tsarist regime, and that is dual polarization. That means that there is a polarization process within the elite, and there's a polarization process between the elite and society. this, what's going on this past year seems to be the beginnings of something like that. And as we all know, this turned into catastrophe for Russia. I don't think that things are going to that dire end, but it does provoke some serious problems. The development of civil society, I'm kind of, I don't really like this word, this term too much, just because people have always looked in Russia for civil society, and it never seems to really develop the way it's supposed to. But we do see some interesting things. I think the response to Krimsk and the volunteerism out of that is really an amazing and important development. And if anything, I think that in actions like that are quite promising. Then again, one of the things I read yesterday is that the election monitoring group Golos is on the verge of financial collapse because USAID is pulled out. They don't have the funding anymore. Therefore, the question then becomes, can civil organizations exist and flourish in Russia based on Russian backing? If Golos collapses, then it looks similar to what people who've criticized it are. They're just an agent of foreigners. Russians, for civil society really to flourish, Russians themselves have to put their financial backing in addition to their own participation.
What about and when we talk about civil society, we're actually talking about two things. We're talking about these civic groups, but we're also talking about this broader, for lack of a better term, middle class. I can't think of anything else to call it. Creative class, whatever you want to call it. There is this broader mass now that is coming to political consciousness. And this, to me, is one of the new variables. This, we didn't have this back in at the end of the Tsarist regime. And you're having kind of wealth, or at least a comfortable life, spread more widely than it ever has been in Russian history. And that has political implications. Do you see that as maybe a different variable that we have now? And I want to get Mark in on this too in a second.
I mean, it depends on how you define the middle class, because a lot of middle class people in Russia are embedded within the benefits and structures that the Putin government has provided. I mean, if you chop up the middle class to include the kind of tech-savvy young urbanites, then yeah, you have, you know, somewhat of that kind of force. But if you think of the middle class in broader terms, like people I know, and say in the provinces, who aren't, they're embedded in construction. They're the last Soviet generation. They've provided more for their children, and they actually graft onto the stability slogans that the Putin system has put forward. So I think the bureaucracy itself is part of that middle class, and that needs to be considered.
And this is where the splits in the elite are actually relevant to the splits to society. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's very important to try and disaggregate some of these terms. If we're talking about middle class, in some ways I'm slightly reminded of the old Russian aristocracy, you know, courtesy of the table of ranks onwards, in which actually you could be an aristocrat, which basically meant that you're a station master, rather than a duke. And likewise, exactly, the new middle class involves a whole variety of people. You know, a police captain would be considered to be middle class, and yet we're not actually necessarily regarding him as a hipster. So, you know, who are we talking about? What has, I think, changed, you know, if we make that comparison and is important, is actually that the modern state is far, far more complex a beast than the late Tsarist one. I mean, I like the dual polarization analogy. And one of the key things is that actually the modern state needs these people a lot more actively. It provides opportunities for them, but it also depends upon them. So I think if we do see, and I think on the whole we have seen signs that this is not just, media and social media sort of people in Moscow and St. Petersburg sort of movement. It is, I think, broadening out. It is including, you know, university academics, God help them, as well as, you know, people who are actually sort of within the technocratic apparatus. It is, I think, a generational point. So, I mean, I think at the moment we're seeing an overly segmented opposition with movement, but I think, you know, we can see it more generally becoming a more class-based one. But the interesting thing is also, is that becomes so much more complex for the state to manage. I'm going back to your point about civil society. Yeah, I think we are seeing exactly a flowering of civil society, including, of course, a lot of expressions of uncivil civil society. I mean, one can look at the Cossack movement, which no one exactly would regard as hipster-friendly, but actually is also an expression of civic identity being given form. But the thing is, again, the whole nature of the power vertical is that it actually regarded society as being quite a simple beast, that it was possible to identify whether it's a handful of key clans and power brokers within the elite or a handful of key constituent strands of opinion within society. And for each of those, you could develop a strategy that was going to control them, buy them off, or whatever. In this increasingly variegated environment, both at the top and at the bottom, it becomes hard to think of how even a master political maneuverer could handle it. And I certainly don't think at the moment we're seeing evidence of mastery in the Kremlin.
So we see what we see is the state becoming more complex and the society becoming more complex at the same time. One of the things I wanted to touch on in this segment is it's something I blogged last week. I saw Sean on Twitter expressed a little bit of skepticism about it, saying it was wishful thinking. But during the week, I blogged about this budding sort of almost maybe alliance that seems to be maybe developing. Did I put enough qualifiers in there? Between between the two Alexeys, Alexei Kudrin, the former finance minister, and Alexei Navalny, of course, the anti-corruption blogger and opposition leader. There are concrete signs that they are kind of making moves toward each other. But why this is important and whether this happens with these two specific people, to me, is less important than the larger phenomenon of the technocratic wing of the elite, which does understand, largely for reasons of self-preservation, that something needs to change right now, that the system does need to open up and become more pluralistic, if for no other reason that it's difficult to diversify and modernize the economy without diversifying and modernizing the political system. If they could join up with the moderate wing of the opposition, not the bomb throwers, but the people that are willing to do kind of a Polish-style roundtable to, you know, negotiate the end of this regime, perhaps, if they could ever link up, this could lead to the kind of evolutionary change that the larger section of the society seems to want. An evolutionary. People are afraid of revolutions, but everybody agrees something has to change. How realistic do you think that development is, Sean?
I think it's a careful dance that the technocratic elite has to play here, because they have the most to lose in this this alliance, right? If they move too far to coddle, say, oppositionists, that makes them a target from the more conservative forces.
As Gudkov found out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they could find themselves suddenly being the target of all sorts of shenanigans, because as we well know, yeah, they may be the technocratic elite, and yes, their hands may be a bit cleaner, assuming their hands are still kind of dirty. So that move exposes them. Ideally, yeah, that would be the right approach. I think for the most part, the technocratic elite could somehow harness the energies of those in the opposition movement that they're closest to. They could even start to bring in some of these kind of fresh thinkers and in a way to kind of present their platform or ideas or path to the public. So in a sense, that would be a good political move. But I think because there's so much to lose in that, my skepticism is still at this moment strong.
No, I actually wanted to go a little farther in that blog, and I pulled myself back saying, wondering if Navalny and Kudrin can end up being the Adam Michnik and the Alexander Kwasniewski, you know, in terms of to push that Polish analogy a little bit farther. But in a lot of ways, those two do seem like the logical players in this game. Navalny very easily could be a member of this elite. Let's be honest, if circumstances had been different. And he and Kudrin, basically, let's face it, on economic matters, they see eye to eye. They're both kind of neoliberal in terms of economics. They're temperamentally, yeah, they're very, very different. But that was just too irresistible to not write. And I was hoping to spark some discussion with it. Mark, what do you think, both about the broader question of the technocrats and the moderate wing of the opposition coming together to forge evolutionary change, and of the possible this, you know, alliance of the Alexeys that I tossed out there this week?
Yeah, I mean, it will be quite interesting to see some kind of Kudralny sort of conglot, because, yeah, exactly, I think they have a lot of similarity. I mean, you know, Navalny is not exactly an outsider. You know, he's a board member of Aeroflot and so forth. And, yes, he and Kudrin have a lot to talk about. But in part, the interesting thing is, actually, Kudrin is quite distinctive in the sense of his ability and his willingness to actually be, on the one hand, still socially and politically a Kremlin insider, and yet willing to reach out. And it might well be that his friendship with Putin gives him a fairly unique krisha, though the Sobchak family knows that that doesn't extend forever and to points. But the point is, who else is there? I think for me, it's hard to know whether Kudrin should be considered to be the point person of an invisible technocratic wing that would like to be able to talk to the opposition, or whether this is just Kudrin, who is, after all, someone who's not afraid to act on his own. And therefore this might be part of, shall I say, the radicalization of Kudrin or the house training of Navalny. But one way or another, we still wait to see. Because I think if we look at the technocrats, and again, it's one of these terms that I seem to be in particularly sort of pedantic mode today. it's worth unpicking who we're talking about. On the one hand, yes, it's essentially relatively economically liberal, if not necessarily politically liberal, members of the apparatus. But also, I mean, you know, actually, we'd have to consider many people within the security apparatus technocrats. And here we go to Sean's point about, you know, whether or not they really are much cleaner than the others. But still, it's a conversation that's taking place within a relatively narrow circle. I mean, to me, if we want to look at a Polish example, I'd actually want to push it further back. What really began to destabilize a heavy-handed authoritarian regime was the Solidarity Movement. And the point about the Solidarity Movement was precisely it was a mass movement. Mm. I think,
backed by the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, there is a point at which you can have as many, and this is really the sort of the whole issue of the coordinating council writ large. You can have as many conversations as you want amongst yourselves and think, well, all my friends agree with me. But if you're still just talking to the people in the room, your traction on the wider processes are often going to be quite limited. So, I mean, I sound like very much of a naysayer. I would want to know, though, you know, this could be something really dramatic if it means more than just one man, one Kudrin, willing to cross that bridge. If he's just simply the first person, the one who can show the others the way. I'm making Matt to be a Moses figure, but there you go.
Yeah, I think the key variable here is how many people, how many divisions does Kudrin have and how many divisions does Navalny have, to quote somebody. If Ms. Sean, you wanted to jump in just
a second. Yeah, I wanted to add just one thing too. And I think one thing we need to remember in this kind of reaching out is the underlying structuring of Russian elite politics is also a system of patrons and clients. And therefore, my first assumption is that in terms of who they would woo, and if we speak about the technocratic elite as a, you know, definable corporate body, I would guess they would actually try to woo, say, Putin rather than a Navalny, just because of the capacity to actually realize the things that they want to do structurally. I mean, to get anything done in Russia, you have to have the networks to mass resources and bodies and to have people on your side.
All right. Well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and zero in on a new report titled The Russian Awakening that was released this week by the Moscow Carnegie Center. I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galliotti, author of numerous books on Russia and of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
The Kremlin continues to control the political space, but they can't control the civil space. This civic awakening is irreversible. The Kremlin's policy towards this seems to be to bottle up this civic energy that emerged a year ago. I don't think this is possible.
That was Masha Lipman of the Moscow Carnegie Center speaking this week to RFRL's Russian service about one of the key conclusions reached in that think tank's new report this week, that this process of a development of civil society, as she argues, is irreversible. Among the other findings in the Carnegie Center report were that the political regime built by Putin has lost its legitimacy with the new middle class, that Russia's economic model of energy-fueled, rent-based capitalism is, quote, cracking, and that the so-called power vertical, or not this podcast and not my blog, but the real one, the one that was created by Putin, in which officials give fealty to the Kremlin in exchange for the license to plunder state assets, is, quote, crumbling. The political status quo is history, the report says, and Russia is now entering uncharted waters. Sean, you're the historian. We've discussed this a lot in the past. How uncharted are these waters?
Of course, historically, no. And here I go again. Again, I go back to this idea of dual polarization. But I think within that, to going back to a point that Mark made earlier, and that is society has become more complex. And I think that this is absolutely key, because the Russian government, despite its historical period, has seen society as a lever that they can mobilize or retract or guide or push in a certain direction. But now what we're seeing in a kind of postmodern society where there's multiple identities, multiple interests, different blocks, that Putin's government, I think, is going to have a harder and harder time cobbling together a coalition that will maintain its legitimacy. This is not to say that it's lost its legitimacy. I don't think that we're close to that point yet. But as time goes on, it's going to have to somehow appeal to different groups and different identities and different interests. Now, one of the things the report brought up that you didn't mention that I think is actually key is the values question.
Yeah. I was hoping one of you would bring that up.
the values question brings in a bunch of interesting social developments. One, as I said, the multiple identities of society, but also generational change, that the values of segments of young people who are more tapped into a kind of global popular culture, who are consumptionist, have a different set of values than, say, traditional kind of older generations, or even the last Soviet generation of Russians. And I think this is a real key thing that we see encapsulated in the Pussy Riot issue.
Yeah, no, this is the Russia's culture war, which was the subject of a podcast that Kirill and I did back during the Pussy Riot trial. Mark, there was one thing that came out of the report that I wanted to send to you, because I thought about you the moment I read it, and that's this idea of that the system of rent-based capitalism, which essentially greases the power vertical, if you can mix a metaphor, if you can grease a vertical, I don't know. But on one hand, how much can a rise in energy prices, on one hand, if this does happen, give kind of a temporary reprieve here? Because what is happening is that there's less resources, right? And bribery is probably not elastic in a downward direction, right? So this is one of the things that we're witnessing right now, specifically with Putin's so-called anti-corruption drive. He's changing the social contract within the elite. The old social contract said, you give fealty to the Kremlin, you pay homage to the man, and you have a license to steal, within certain, parameters. Now that is changing, and it's changing the whole game. You've brought this up a lot of times. Can you expand on that now? How much of this is about the economy, and how much of it can be saved by rising energy prices?
Yeah, I mean, the depressing truth for all of us who are not economists is that, sadly, the economy usually runs and guides and directs and controls everything. We just try to ignore that. That said, I don't think there's a nice, neat equation that says high oil and gas prices equals everything's fine in the Kremlin.
No, of course, they're not that. They're not exactly that low now.
No, exactly. I don't see that the rent-based system is exactly collapsed. I mean, I think the thing about the Carnegie report is, I would say, it says a lot of good things, and then it dials them up to 11. I see everything that they're describing, but I just perhaps see it in slightly less vivid, less immediate, less apocalyptic colors.
I've seen a lot of things they were describing written on all three of our blogs throughout the past year.
Well, exactly. But so if we look at what's happening, if there is lots of money in the system, it certainly gives the power vertical, which in some ways now has become the Putin vertical because it has become so sort of personalized around him, it gives them more options. However, what we've not seen is any particular skill in working out how to allocate those resources. For me, it's not actually just simply that the Kremlin has run out of money to buy people off. They're still ample for that. I mean, there's still money that they could move around and so forth. It's actually that they're doing a bad job of it. And in part, the anti-corruption campaign is a reflection of that. It's a realization that the people they were buying off 5 years ago, 2 years ago, 20 years ago, are not necessarily the people they need to be buying off now. They're not the constituencies that matter anymore. So on the one hand, we're talking about a new social contract. Yes, it sort of says, well, look, you know, there are different rules of the game. What we're seeing is essentially a belief in the Kremlin that it actually needs to redirect its relationships with elites and re-identify who are the important elites. The trouble is they're not really sure. I think this is a problem. So I don't think it's a lack of administrative resources. It's a lack of creativity, imagination, and knowledge as to how to apply them. So, of course, if there is a sudden dramatic fall in the Kremlin's revenues, so it can't even pay off its existing supporters, that'll be a problem. But I don't necessarily see that if there's an expansion of Kremlin revenue, it will necessarily buy them security.
Do you think there's also a problem right now with communication where it's not clear what you're able to do anymore within the power vertical? Because they're changing the rules of the game in midstream right now, and it's not really clear what the new rules are. Or maybe the rules are clear and we just don't know about it.
No, I don't think they are. I mean, I think this is the point. Change is the hardest thing possibly to manage. In many ways, it's actually... It's always appealing to think from the point of view of an entrenched leadership that they have identified the wave and that they can ride it and come through. Actually, that's usually a disastrous thing because what tends to happen is you alienate the existing bulwarks of your power before or without creating new bulwarks. And again, I think that's probably what we're seeing. Again, this is not going to be a rapid and immediate process. You know, reading the Carnegie report, I almost felt that they were anticipating that within a few months, Putin would be being tarred and feathered and driven from Moscow. it's not going to happen. You know, it is irreversible, but it's irreversible in tectonic senses. You know, we're talking about something that might take 6 months, more likely to take 6 years. But nonetheless, I think we are seeing a process that is no longer amenable to change, merely acceleration or deceleration.
Yeah, one of the other things Ed Lucas said to me when I spoke to him this week was that we're not seeing the end of the Putin era, but we certainly are seeing the beginning of the end. Sean, your thoughts?
The Carnegie report brings up a lot of interesting developments that I also identify with going on in Russia. And one of the more interesting ones that I don't know a lot about, but I think it's worth thinking about, is the development of regional centers of economic power and possibly even political power, and how in a time like this, if through the anti-corruption campaign, that the rules are kind of destabilized, this allows for those regional centers to either look to Moscow and try to figure out what the new rules are, or start looking away, or looking in their own immediate kind of fiefdom, if one may put it in those terms. And I think that one of the challenges that the next, 6 years for Putin will be, how do you recapture or even maintain those regional centers of power, regional centers of economic power? And to some extent, the anti-corruption campaign is a kind of warning of that, trying to maintain repatriate wealth in Russia, maintain it in Russia, but also crack down on some of the pet projects that are funded or patronized by Putin, and making sure that they run somewhat smoothly. And so I think that's an interesting development worth thinking about.
Yeah, one of the things I took away from it in terms of the region is that it's the things seem to be moving, or there seems to be pressure pushing things toward a situation similar to we had during the Yeltsin years, where the regional, where you had 89 little Soviet unions, basically, where each of the then 89 subjects of the Federation that existed then were pretty much semi-autonomous, and there was a lot. There wasn't really a lot that the center could do to control microdevelopments there. Putin changed that, but now it seems like centrifugal force is taking its toll again. One of the things I also wanted to get at is it too late for Putin to adapt and get ahead of this curve? I did this post this week on the maybe Putin rebranding that we might be seeing based on that report in Nezavisnaya Gazeta that Vladimir the tough guy is out, Vladimir the wise is in. Mark, what do you think? Can Putin get ahead of the curve on this thing?
Honestly, I don't think so.
I don't either.
It's theoretically possible, but I think knowing him and knowing the machinery he's built around him, I think it's unlikely. And again, I think it misses the point about just how corrosive it is to seek to rebrand and recreate yourself. In the sort of spirit of new soda drink of choice, what tends to happen is that actually you alienate all the people who got used to the old one. Putin the wise patriarch, yes, maybe it sort of speaks to certain kind of loamy Russian traditions and such like, but actually what it would involve is weakening what was in many ways the most powerful element of brand Putin, which is basically, this is one mean SOB who you don't want to mess with. Mm-hmm. He is the toughest guy, the biggest, baddest dog in the pack. Now suddenly you want to make him all avuncular and twinkly. Well, apart from that, I honestly don't see Putin doing twinkly. But beyond that, exactly. I mean, it means he will have to devalue himself. And if we're going back to this point, and I think I agree entirely with you both about the extent to which we're seeing this fragmentation and decentralization of power, a rise of all kinds of cabals, clanlets, and circles, institutional, personal, regional, and so forth. Because, you know, if we're talking about a value change, I think the key thing is actually a value change within the elite that is moving into effectively a survivalist mode, rather than a, you know, ultimately the czar decides everything kind of mode. Now, in that case, how does happy, friendly, shiny Putin appeal to these you know, very pragmatic, hard-nosed people who are sitting there thinking, I'm living very well out of the embezzlement and other opportunities? If Putin is going to become more of the sort of the father of the people, one of the things he's going to have to do is follow through with that anti-corruption campaign. It can't just simply be a handful of increasingly insignificant figures within Moscow. You know, it really will actually have to dig down and catch the corruption that is affecting ordinary people's lives. And at the point at which he does that, Putin begins to become dangerous to a whole stratum of the elite. So I really don't see how he can manage it without some sort of dramatic external threat or external challenge or opportunity arising to sort of to bail him out.
Sean?
The Putin the wise is a very good idea. It's just 4 years too late. In the sense that if, you know, one of the prospects of if let's, you know, in some kind of imaginative world that Putin is able to craft this image and it somehow works and all the dire things that Mark correctly says that might happen don't take place. What it does, it allows for the platform to start grooming a post-Putin era. It starts building, branding Putin as the elder statesman, as someone who's kind of stepping back. But the question then is, if you have Putin the wise, who's going to be the stick, right? Who's going to take the place of that very necessary instrument of maintaining some kind of vertical of power to run this enormous complex country?
You hit on something that just, I'm sorry to cut you off. You hit on something that just came to my mind. As I was reading the Nezavisnaya report, I said, this is a year too late. Because this was the perfect role for Putin to move into if he was going to leave Medvedev in the presidency, right? Go ahead and finish your thought.
Yeah, I think that this could be, if they go through with this, it could at least allow for the space of saying, you know, because ostensibly this idea is Putin stepping back. And then you start to allow a new kind of face of the government to start, you know, planting itself And being more visible publicly. But again, the problem is that, you know, like with any, you know, riding a horse, if you let loose the reins too much, mm-hmm. you lose control of the horse.
Right.
So I think this is it's on the surface a good possible political development, but I think in the current state of structural and issues going on and the fragmentation across the board of Russian society and Russian state, it also is a very dangerous thing. I mean, this goes back to one of my general ideas about Putin and Russian governance in general, the tendency to centralize. But when you centralize too much, it atrophies everything mm-hmm. outside the centralization. Mm-hmm. But when you decentralize, then things really start to unravel. You know, you kind of open up the floodgates and things go in all sorts of directions and you lose control. And I think that Putin is definitely in this position right now.
Right. Well, we've covered a lot of ground here. We've got literally a few minutes before we got to wrap up. But one thing I did want to do with both of you is say, what are the trends briefly that you're looking for in 2013? Mark.
No pressure. Okay, I would say what we're going to see is basically three trends taking place. One is precisely an attempt to rebrand not just Putin but the state. That it's going to be, yes, Putin the wise but tough. He will reach out in sorrow, not in anger, when he has to discipline people. And therefore, we're going to see a sort of a moderate anti-corruption campaign, but it won't be enough. It won't be something systemic. And therefore, I think it'll soon lose its momentum. Second process we're going to see is the opposition actually beginning to fragment, which will be a good thing, because it'll mean you'll actually begin to see ideological blocks, real opposition movements, rather than just a generic, we want Russia without Putin thing. But it'll be a painful process in the meantime. And the third thing is actually, again, continuing this survivalism mode within the elite. We're going to see more people beginning to toy with the idea of defection to the opposition, people opening up back channels. The interesting thing will be when we begin to see the economic elite, as in the oligarchs and the minigarchs, beyond Prokhorov and his sort of whatever his experiment is, trying to reach out to the elite, because that'll be a very dangerous. Sorry, trying to reach out from the elite, because that'll be very dangerous for the state.
Mm-hmm. Sean?
Oh boy, this is really hard to say. I, in terms of my own kind of personal watching, I will be interested to see what direction the opposition takes, and if they learn from and kind of sitting back and reevaluating the last year and reading the articles of this kind of evaluations that are in the press right now. It's interesting to me that all of them are focusing on the glory days, the glory revolutionary days of December and through May. But nobody seems to be thinking hard about what happened after May up until this point, where you say, I think, right, correctly, they lost controlling the agenda. Right, yeah. Or at least some of their agenda is somewhat co-opted.
Yeah, up until Putin's re-election, they had control
right.
of the agenda.
Exactly. And so how are they going to recapture this agenda, and how are they going to start making the move to really starting to make connections with society, so elements of society? That's one thing I think is worth watching. Second is I think the development in some of the economic reforms and budget reforms that are taking place right now. You see a lot of discussions about introducing a sales tax. You see efforts to reform the education system, reform the health system, reform the pension system. How this is going to play out in society on the one hand, but also within the elite itself, because these disagreements are also the undercurrent of those disagreements are also these kind of, you know, personal infighting, clan wars, whatever, however you want to categorize them. So how that works out and what kind of shape the government will take as a result will be interesting to see. Lastly, I think Putin himself and I think the appendage that he has with him, that is United Russia and this People's Front or whatever this is, how these are going to rebrand themselves, because there is a promise of this after December 2011, and it hasn't seemed to, at least from my observations, really move forward. And the best indication of that is how many United Russia people ran in the municipal elections as independents.
Yeah, that was a very interesting development.
So how are they going to restructure the face, the political face of the Putin government will be, if at all, will be something worth looking at.
Okay, well, if 2012 was the year of the holding pattern, we'll meet up again at the same time next year and see if 2013 was the year of decision. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining us from New York, New York, has been NYU Professor Mark Galeotti, an expert in Russia security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russian blog. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And a big thanks to our awesome producer, Tanya Koncheva, and to my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, and his equally indispensable Twitter feed, Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. See you again next week. Kirill will be back from the North Pole, and perhaps I can talk one of these two characters into joining us. And as always now, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.